Welcome to another episode of the SaaS Podcast. I'm your host, Omar Khan, and this is a show where I interview proven founders and industry experts who share their stories, strategies, and insights to help you build, launch, and grow your SaaS business. In this episode, I talk to Michael Kumleitner, the founder and CEO of Walls.io, a social media content aggregator, and SWAT.io, a social media management platform. In 2008, while working as a software developer, Michael spotted an opportunity to start an agency specializing in Facebook app development. A few years later, after seeing his clients struggle with managing their Facebook communities, he launched SWAT.io to help solve the problem. But finding his first 10 customers took nearly 2 years. Around that time, a friend asked Michael to create a tool for aggregating and showcasing social media posts on TV screens at a co-working event. Now, realizing its broader potential, Michael quickly turned the tool into another product called Walls.io soon after the event. But growth was slow for both products. It took many years and a lot of hard work and persistence to get traction. Then the pandemic hit, causing big problems for Walls.io as live events suddenly stopped. Michael and his team had to quickly pivot to keep the product alive. Although he believed he could handle everything, the challenge of running the agency and building two products eventually became too much for Michael. That's when he decided to focus mainly on Walls.io, realizing he had to use his time and energy better. And that decision paid off significantly. Today, his two product companies generate over $10 million in annual revenue. In this episode, you'll learn how Michael navigated the initial challenges of building SWAT.io and Walls.io, including the struggles to find his first customers, what strategies Michael implemented to pivot Walls.io during the pandemic, and how that change significantly impacted the company's growth. We talk about how Michael balanced running two bootstrap companies and the lessons this taught him about entrepreneurship and growth, how Walls.io leveraged SEO, content marketing, and search ads as key growth tactics, and a surprising growth channel that failed. And finally, we talk about some of the unique challenges and lessons Michael's faced as a bootstrap solo founder, growing his business to over $10 million in annual revenue. So I hope you enjoy it. Are you looking to sell your online business or buy one to start your entrepreneurial journey? Discover exciting opportunities with Bupos.com. Bupos is the number one platform for buying and selling profitable online businesses and the first to offer built-in acquisition financing for qualified buyers. At Bupos.com, you can explore their exclusive listings, browse listings from other marketplaces, or submit your own deal for approval. Bupos can offer pre-approved financing for recurring revenue businesses, allowing you to access fast funding with no personal guarantees. And their experienced M&A advisory team supports you every step of the way. To learn more, visit sasclub.io/Bupos. That's sasclub.io/BOOPOS. Sign up today and get qualified to sell your business or find your next deal. Is your team struggling with spreadsheets that can't keep up with your workflows? It's time to switch to JotForm Tables. JotForm Tables is an all-in-one workspace that lets you collect, organize, and manage data seamlessly. Not only can you create online forms to gather data directly in JotForm Tables, but it also serves as a powerful tool to manage and analyze the data collected from your existing JotForm forms. You can also import spreadsheets or enter information manually, and all your data is stored securely in one place. JotForm Tables makes collaboration a breeze. You can share your tables with a single click and work with your team in real time. Say goodbye to version control issues and hello to efficient teamwork. Get started with JotForm Tables for free today at sasclub.io/JotForm. That's sasclub.io/JotForm. Hey there, SaaS founders. Are you looking to grow your B2B SaaS business to the first million in annual recurring revenue? I've got something that can help you. Introducing the SaaS Club newsletter, your weekly source of proven strategies, practical insights, and exclusive interviews with successful B2B SaaS founders who've been in your shoes and are ready to share what they've learned. Each week, you'll get a quick 5-minute read delivered straight to your inbox, full of growth tactics, lessons learned, and insider tips to help you tackle those early stage challenges and grow your business to 7 figures and beyond. So what are you waiting for? Head over to sasclub.io/newsletter and join over 4,000 other SaaS founders and entrepreneurs who are already using these insights to grow their businesses. Subscribe to the SaaS Club newsletter today and get the support you need to keep moving forward on your SaaS journey. Michael, welcome to the show.
Hi, Omer. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Do you have a favorite quote, something that inspires or motivates you that you can share with us?
Yeah, I do. I did think about it a lot. And since I've been a founder of two SaaS companies, Bootstrap both, and both times a solo founder, I really love this quote, which is taken from a book from Sarah Lacey. And she originally titled her book, Once You're Lucky, Twice You're Good. And I adapted that slogan for myself, since I'm a two times founder, once you're lucky, twice you're stupid, because sometimes I really felt very stupid doing it twice at the same time, alone and bootstrapped. The book is very good, though, and definitely also a recommendation.
Yeah, that's the key there. It's not that you're a second time founder. It's that you've built two companies in parallel. And I think that's a really interesting part of your story, as we were talking earlier. Number one, you're bootstrapped. Number two, you're a solo founder. Number three, you have built these two companies in parallel. And number four, you're not in Silicon Valley, right? Like all the things that people say you need to be doing. So we're gonna have some fun with this conversation and figure out what you've done, because you've obviously done something right here. Why don't we start by you telling us about Walls.io? What does the product do? Who's it for? And what's the main problem you're trying to solve? And then also tell us about the second company, SWOT.io.
Sure. Happy to do so, Omar. So Walls.io is, of course, it's a B2B SaaS product in the social media marketing space. And our pitch is that Walls.io engages your audience with user-generated content, and by that increases engagement and brand awareness, whether that's at events or on your website or on your mobile app. Anywhere you want to use user-generated content to increase engagement, that's where Walls.io comes in. And the second company, SWOT.io, is a social media management tool. So that's a very, very classical software category, a tool that allows social media marketing professionals to streamline their community management, their content planning, analytics, everything that the social media manager does every day.
Give us a sense of the size of the business. Where are you in terms of revenue, size of team, number of customers?
All in all, we are now more than 65 team members. That's about 45 coming from SWOT.io and about 20 from Walls.io. We are coming from the same parent company. We are still sharing an office, so sometimes it's hard to say who's working for which company. And so it's 65 in total, and I don't disclose any revenue numbers per se, but what I can tell you, what I'm very proud of and also thankful for all my team, is that we have been able to cross the 10 million US dollars annual revenue, both businesses combined.
Okay, so let's talk about how you got started. I think you started SWOT.io first, and then about a year later you launched Walls.io. So why don't we go back to those days? Like, what year was that, and what were you doing at the time?
Let's go back down the memory lane. That's almost 15 years ago, I think. I used to be a software developer myself back then. And I still remember 2008. I found it super, super exciting when Facebook first launched their first public API, their platform. So I was dabbling around in my bedroom, building tiny little, and I would say stupid little applications on top of Facebook. And out of that, I've created my first business, which was a tiny boutique software agency focusing on building marketing apps on Facebook and other social media platforms. So that was the first real business I created or founded myself. However, pretty quickly I became aware that I don't see myself in running an agency forever. I wanted to do product, so I was happy that blessed, I would say, that from the agency business I was able to develop the product ideas together with my team for both SWOT.io and Walls.io. And you're right, SWOT.io was founded or created first as a product that's pretty much 10 years ago in 2013. It's sometimes hard to pinpoint the exact date because there used to be long periods of prototyping and being unsure whether this is a self-sustainable business until we really jumped into the cold water and said, okay, now let's make this a real product. And then I think 2 years later, or one year, 1 year, 1 or 2 years later, we did the same thing again with Walls.io.
Okay, so let's talk about SWOT first. So 2013, how did you come up with the idea? You know, you said you wanted to start building a product business, get out of this agency business. I remember those days, by the way. I remember when everyone said Facebook apps were the thing that were going to change the world. And, you know, there was kind of like this gold rush to go and build these apps. Were you just constantly looking for a product idea around that time and trying to figure out how to get out of the agency business? Or was this something that, you know, opportunistically you came across and decided to pursue?
Yeah, so both happened at the same time. I was trying to find ideas myself, and we did side projects here and there, but nothing really, really stuck and nothing really turned out viable. But the good news was we only had to look very close at our agency customers to basically find the ideas ready-made for us. So the companies we were working with, like you said, social media apps were the hot. Sorry, forgive my pardon my French back then. And suddenly huge or bigger companies and brands started to build Facebook communities, and they were having trouble because once you have a certain community size of community, you have to deal with lots of incoming customer requests, with spam. You have suddenly two or three people posting at the same time, and you need a tool to manage that. It was not really a big invention on our end, but we just saw what our bigger agency customers were having trouble with, and then started to build a solution for that.
Okay. And let's talk about like what you did in terms of, you know, validating the idea. Was this more about, okay, you just started building the product, or did you kind of go through and do the, you know, customer validation thing and interview some of your customers? Like, how did you get to a point where you were like, I'm confident that, you know, we're going to invest time and money into building this product, we're going to bootstrap, right? So you don't have the benefit of you know, having raised any money, and you've got an agency business to keep running at the time.
So that's a lot of questions to unpack. First, we didn't do what today you would recommend to do, like doing customer research, validating a product idea. We were way too naive. I was way too naive to do that. Also, for a very, very long time, I really thought like this. Yeah, this is a side project, really. Maybe I can sell it to 10 or 20 agency customers that would have been already like paradise for me. So nowadays, SWOT.io has, I think, more than 700 customers, right? So, so the vision wasn't fully developed yet in my head, to be honest. Yeah. So, so that's the criticism I would see for myself looking back. What we did right is that we were working on the product very closely with our future customers. We really made sure to build the first prototype. Not within months, probably even within weeks, and get our customers their hands on it and start using it. They didn't pay yet, of course, but they gave us a lot of feedback, which mostly helped us in really finding that sweet spot and later reaching what you would call product market fit. Although I have to say it's also dangerous. If you only have like a handful of existing agency customers who give you feedback, that can also very easily drive the product management, the product direction into a wrong way. So you get easily distracted by a single customer who has these crazy demands and crazy ideas, which might sound right for them, but will never be applicable to a broader number of customers. So that was difficult to navigate. And if I'm honest, there's still, I think even to this day, you will still find the odd feature in our product that clearly can be traced back to one specific customer who had a lot of, who had a big presence in our minds and therefore influenced product management.
How long did it take for you to get your first 10 customers, and do they all come from existing agency clients?
Yeah, I would say the first 10 customers definitely took more than 1 year, something between 1 or 2 years. So it was really a kind of slow process, but that also has to do with some lessons I had to learn during that time. We can talk about that later. And those first 10 to 20 customers, they were not exclusively existing agency customers. Luckily, what we achieved was that these early agency customers then started to spread the word, and then new customers were joining. So after this 1 or 2 year period, we were pretty sure that we have a viable product on our hands, something that it's worth to really go not all in, but definitely allocate significant resources towards.
Okay. So it took a couple of years to get the first 10 customers for SWAT. And presumably it wasn't, you know, an easy thing to do because you've still got to run the agency. You've still got to get money coming in, pay the bills, you know, keep the lights on, all that stuff, while you're allocating resources for a fair amount of time without generating revenue. So that sounds like a challenging situation anyway. But in the middle of that, you then decide, let's launch another product. How did that happen?
Sort of, yes. So just to get the timeline straight, the second product, Wazio, was launched 1 or 2 years after SWATIO. And at this point, I was already pretty much committed on SWATIO. Although you could ask me how committed was I when I came up with the second product idea. So I was probably not fully committed yet. Again, this came the idea for Waz.io, which at its core is a social media content aggregator. So it collects user generated content from all sorts of social media platforms. The idea for that came again from a very specific customer need, or it wasn't actually a customer. It actually was a friend of mine who was throwing an event at a co-working space. And we didn't have so many of those in Vienna back then. And we just wanted to create a fun element for this event, a video screen collecting and encouraging everyone to post on Twitter and on platforms which are now long forgotten, like Foursquare, if anyone in your audience still remembers that. We didn't have Instagram back then. So the idea came again from close ally / customer / partner. And once we built that for this event, suddenly other people were asking for it. So again, I had the feeling, maybe this could be more than a side project, a one-off project. Maybe we could productize this. So it was very much the same or similar story on how we came up with the idea. But of course, in hindsight, I might have just said no and focused on the first idea, but I just couldn't say no to a great product idea that was put right in front of me.
I'm curious, you know, when we talk about the two products today, they are clearly different, serve a very, you know, clear purpose and need. But in the early days, you could kind of put them both into a social media app bucket, right? So it possibly would have been as easy to say, let's just build all of this into one product. Did you go through that thought process where it's like, why aren't we just, you know, building this Uber product for social media that does all of these things versus saying, no, let's just do this completely different, completely separately, its own brand, it's, you know, how did you make that decision?
That's a great question. We did consider that for a while. The issue that I saw and still see, if you want to have like this 360 social media suite, that beast that can do everything, we would not have been able to pull that off in the way we were bootstrapped. So this there would have been way more like other competitors, which we otherwise wouldn't have to face. Bigger competitors funded with hundreds or at least dozens of millions of capital, who were able to offer this suite with way more features. There was not just SWATIO and Wazio. There was social media paid advertising. There was monitoring or listening. So if you really wanted to compete in this suite with this suite approach, we wouldn't have been able to create all those products in our bootstrap situation. So that was off the table. And I think another reason for deciding to have two independent products, which later became also independent legal entities. Separate companies. Another reason for that was to really allow both products and later both companies to grow and develop on their own individual growth trajectory. So they weren't like tied to each other so strong. They could all both find their way, which also, of course, at one point gives you more flexibility when you're looking for partners. Maybe if you at one point decide to look for M&A scenarios, or if you're looking for investments, that at a later stage, I think that's all easier if you have mostly separated companies, separate entities who can go their own way. But still, you are absolutely right. I'm not saying this was the absolute right or best decision. It turned out well for me and for our companies. But who knows? Who knows what would have happened if we went the other way, as you suggested? So I'm not saying this is like the only solution or the best one neither. But that was my thinking back then.
You know, when we were talking earlier, you said to me, you know, mixing agency and product doesn't work, at least, you know, for us. Looking back at it now, you know, things worked out, got you to where you are today. But I'm guessing trying to do both caused more problems than maybe, you know, you wanted to deal with at the time.
Yeah, sure. That is true. The question, of course, is always, do you really have a choice? Especially, do you have a choice when bootstrapping? Because you have to pay your bills and your salary somehow, right? If you're not lucky enough to get that capital from some earlier venture, or I don't know, from friends, families, fools, you will have to bankroll the development of your SaaS product somehow. And I think in general, having a working agency, software agency business is a great way to bankroll that first 1 or 2 years of product development. But as you said rightly, it comes at a cost, and it has to be navigated very consciously. Things I probably only learned along the way, and which in hindsight slowed us down unnecessarily. I guess the biggest and in hindsight, of course, obvious learning is trying to have as dedicated as possible personal resources for agency and product as possible. So in the first year or so, we didn't have that. We had a handful of engineers. Really, we didn't have much else than engineers, to be honest. And they were available for work both on product and agency. Now, of course, what happens, and I'm hearing that from similar founder stories, so I don't think I'm unique in that. I think a lot of people go through that. A lot of bootstrappers, by the way, are coming from agency backgrounds. It's also a very common trait. So the mistake was not to have like separation in resources. So of course, short-term revenue was calling, like an agency customer is asking for that super important project that has to be done by 4 weeks. And of course, what that meant is for the next 4 weeks, nobody would work on our product. Everyone was focusing on the agency project. Yeah, we would get some cash flow, but we didn't have focus. And that definitely cost us a lot of time, at least in the first year, maybe even a bit longer, until I understood that there's no way to build, for me at least, for us at least, to build to have enough velocity in building the product than by basically installing like a firewall and making absolutely clear that the first engineer moving them over to the product side, and he is not allowed to have to do anything with agency projects. Then as soon as I saw some traction, move over the second engineer and so on and so on. You could do the same with marketing and sales, although we were like very much engineering driven back then.
Kind of beyond the, you know, in the first 10 customers for both Walls and SWAT, were you selling basically to both products to the same type of customer, to agencies?
That was a big overlap. And for a long time, at first, we didn't have neither sales nor marketing specialists. So as so many bootstrappers, I had to not level up, but change my roles. I was first very much focused on engineering, then building the product ideas. Then I had to do marketing. Then I had to do sales. So basically, it was me for a long time trying to sell and market those products. And yes, it helped that the target audience has a very big overlap, which of course the persona is a social media marketing professional. So that certainly helped, although there were also a lot of differences in terms of the markets we were playing in. SWAT.io was very much focused on German-speaking markets. Also, it was worldwide from the get-go, but still there was overlap, and that certainly helped.
So let's talk about growth. So one of the bigger growth channels for you has been content and SEO. Like, what was the approach you took? What was the thinking as you were starting to build out your kind of marketing plan here? Because I'm guessing at the time, you were the marketing team, right? So is this just you on your own figuring this out?
In the beginning, yes. Although marketing was the first position I could actually, I'm not sure, maybe I'm mixing up marketing and sales. One of those were really the first positions I could really afford to hire a professional. I think at Swadio it was sales, and at marketing it was marketing, which makes sense because one is more direct sales heavy, the other is more self-service product led. So yes, for Swadio it was definitely marketing. So for Swadio, being like very self-service focused and having a worldwide target audience, we felt like going all in on the marketing side made a lot of sense. And we were pretty early in that new software category of user-generated content tools. We didn't even have the word UGC back then, I think. So that meant there was still a lot of space in terms of content marketing and therefore effective SEO. And so that definitely helped. That wouldn't work today. If I would launch a UGC tool or a social media marketing tool today, it's very, very hard to be successful with content. It will take forever since the spaces are so saturated. Back then it was still possible, and of course it's still even today worth it pursuing such an approach, because organic SEO is still the only thing that really that has the best scale still, while other channels might be clogged or saturated sooner or later. Owned organic profile on SEO is what always works.
So you if I kind of recap that, it was you feel that one of the reasons you were able to get content marketing and SEO working was largely to do with timing. You were pretty early, you know, entering that space around user-generated content, and the market wasn't as saturated as it is today with so many social media tools. So that helped you create content and start ranking faster and getting discovered by customers. Are you an entrepreneur looking to buy a profitable online business or a founder ready to sell? Bupos is the number one platform for buying and selling profitable online businesses. With their exclusive listings, as well as listings from other marketplaces, and the option to submit your own deal for approval, Bupos has you covered. Plus, they're the first to offer built-in acquisition financing for qualified buyers of recurring revenue businesses, allowing you to access fast funding without personal guarantees. And their experienced M&A advisory team supports you every step of the way. To learn more, visit sasclub.io/Bupos. That's sasclub.io/BOOPOS. Sign up today and get qualified to start your entrepreneurial journey or sell your business at the right valuation with Bupos.com.
Certainly, but of course, it was still necessary to provide really, really great content that was actually valuable for users, existing users, potential leads. So there's no way around that. If you invest in content and make sure it's really high quality, and we did our share of mistakes here as well, like hiring external agencies who would like churn out piece after piece, but really not ideally aligned with our customers' needs. So in the end, we learned, hey, we should really do it ourselves, or at least learn how to do it ourselves first before we let someone from outside doing it. So we did our share of mistakes. We did also a few intuitively smart things, like making sure that we gave away a lot. So very early on, we started to give away free licenses to NGOs, to nonprofits, and we just asked for links in exchange. Hey, please mention us as a sponsor. Link, here's our logo. Please link it on your website. They usually put it somewhere in the footer, so it's linked from every page. So over time, that really helped us build a good link profile.
Yeah, that's a good strategy in terms of going after NGOs and those sorts of organizations. I'm assuming that they have like pretty decent kind of domain ratings, right?
Very often, yeah. It happens a lot. It could be organizations in the academic space, which tend to have very good, very high rated domains. Even if the single link is not like as valuable, if you do this constantly and over years, there's a lot of things happening, positive things happening.
I want to go back to what you just mentioned about hiring agencies to churn out content and that not really working. And I've seen that over and over again. Many startups go through that process. Some maybe are more successful than others. But it's not the first time I'm hearing we eventually had to bring it in-house. I know it's quite some time back, many years ago. But if you had to summarize, like, what was the biggest difference between the type of content these agencies were producing versus the type of content you were able to produce in-house? Like, how is it different, and what specifically do you think made the difference in terms of it resonating with your potential customers and helping to drive leads?
Well, I would like to start with saying I'm not even like throwing any agency we have been working with under the bus here. I really think it was more like our own mistake to outsource work prematurely before we even understood it ourselves. So we didn't know enough about our customer profile. We didn't know enough how we could provide value. So and if we don't know who are the closest to our customer, how should an agency know? There's always at least one or two layers between the agency and our end customers. I think it's almost impossible to bridge that gap. So we first had to start to learn ourselves what kind of content provides value, who we are going to target, on which channels and stuff like that. Once we figured that out, we just were able to create content that was much more aligned with those requirements and with those goals. So maybe if we would have done it the other way around, invest and build knowledge first on our own and then work with a super professional agency, it might have turned out differently. I think the big mistake here was, hey, we don't need to hire our own marketing professional. We can immediately outsource this. Like from a CEO perspective, I thought like, hey, I know, I understand, I need to do, or I believe I need to do content marketing. I currently can't afford a full-time professional. Let's outsource this without having any personal experience or expertise with content marketing. And that is a recipe that, of course, is bound to go wrong. I should have first invested in my own in-house marketing professional who could then guide an agency and really make it work. I think that's an important advice for if you are a solo founder and you have like a certain area of your experience. For me, that was engineering/product. You got to understand those other important areas first, sales, marketing, before you hand it over to someone completely outside of your organization.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. And it's not just content, it's everything, right?
It applies to most or all the things, I guess. Yeah.
I remember somebody saying to me many, many years ago that you outsource stuff that you have got a handle on, you understand, and then you want to, you know, get somebody to help run that so you can free up your team potentially to do something else. And that if you don't really have a handle on it, if you're not really doing that well yourself and you outsource it, chances are the problem is just going to get worse.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the same thing today when you don't think about agencies, but think about even lower price alternatives, like, I don't know, going to Upwork or Fiverr.com. It will be the same thing. If you don't understand the task and how it should be done correctly yourself, that will never work. Similar, if you start thinking about outsourcing these tasks to an AI, great idea, but you should have understood the task first before you put it into ChatGPT.
Right. The other growth channel that you were able to get working was paid advertising. And as you and I were talking earlier, the interesting thing here was that you got search ads working, but not social media ads. And I think it's a little ironical that, you know, you're selling a social media product and yet social media advertising wasn't effective or helpful, and yet search ads were. So just kind of help us understand what you went through, what you tried, and then I have a few other questions I'd love to ask you about that.
Well, yeah, you could say it's ironic. You could even also say like it's almost embarrassing, but it's the truth. Well, I mean, search ads, of course, luckily worked out pretty soon and without too much hassle. Of course, search ads work because of the clear buyer intent. And once our category was starting to be established, there was enough volume, people looking for social media management tools or people searching for even social media walls, which is like lower volume, but still there's enough intent there. So it was easy to work with that and make it also work with enough return on investment, because both my companies, both our products were at a comparatively high price point. So we never went like a low price strategy. So it was relatively easy to recoup whatever we paid for clicks or for conversions through our customer lifetime. So figuring out paid search was relatively easy, although it has to be said, it's not getting easier over time. So everyone, I think, well, maybe it's different in consumer land, but in B2B software land, I think paid advertising has a clear tendency also to reach a glass ceiling, to saturate, also getting more expensive the more competitors you have. So it's not all fine and easy, which brings me back to my first point that organic SEO and reach is basically the holy grail that we are all looking for. Now, to the social media paid advertising, I mean, in hindsight, it's clear what we made wrong here. Advertising on social media doesn't hook into an existing buyer intent, but does aim much earlier in the customer journey of your future client, your future customer. And I think while that is pretty much obvious, what we didn't understand is that for catching or touching a customer very early in their journey, like when they even don't know that there is a demand for the problem we are solving, we need to provide much different and much broader, for example, content to make such a funnel work. We just didn't do it. We sort of understood that there is no intent yet, but basically use the same copy, the same landing pages, the same ebooks, and addressed with the same material as addressed the customer who is much, much earlier and doesn't even know about us yet. Well, I guess that was bound to be a failure, and we wasted quite some money on that. We are still working on it, by the way. It's not done for us yet. Of course, if you broaden up your funnel in this way, that usually means you need to invest more in creating the appropriate content, and that's not always easy for a bootstrap company. But we are getting there, and we're also learning still a lot of where we ideally can reach our audience. LinkedIn is a very interesting opportunity that works better than many other platforms. So yeah, we are learning.
Yeah, so I think now that you describe it that way, it seems pretty obvious, but it's a very easy mistake to make until you get clarity on what stage of the customer journey the buyer is at. And it's very different when somebody is looking for some kind of user-generated social media tool on Google and finding you, and the intent is to find a tool, buy a tool, etc., versus somebody discovering the ad on Facebook while they were, you know, checking a feed about what their friends were up to. And they may potentially still be a buyer, but one, there's no intent. Two, they may be so early in the journey that they don't even realize they need to be creating user-generated content, right? So you have a whole different type of, you know, education kind of process you need to go through before they'll even be thinking about, you know, looking for a tool like yours.
Absolutely. And it took us a while to get clear on that, or to understand that that whole customer journey, like thinking about where is this social media marketing professional? How could we create demand with them? How could we explain our solution, educate them on that? And also very often that, like I mentioned before, that means creating, investing more into content. I mean, a Google search ad is pretty easy to create, even like 100 variations of it. Yeah. But for targeting a customer in this early stage, you will probably maybe need something more visual, something more emotional. You might have to invest into video and stuff like that. And yeah, that took us a while to figure out and to allocate the right resources to it to get that going.
The other channel which has turned out to be crucial for helping drive growth over the last couple of years and possibly helping you cross that 10 million ARR mark, has been working with channel partners and doing integrations. So, you know, integrations can mean a whole bunch of things, right? And partnerships. So just tell me what that meant for you and what was it that you were doing that finally started working?
So this is mostly about the second company, about Walls.io, because we have a really strong channel partnership program there. It actually happened in 2020, right in the middle of the pandemic. Back then, Walls.io was still, to a large extent, used for events, for trade shows, conferences, all of which didn't happen anymore in March 2020. So as a solo founder, that kept me awake for quite a while until we luckily understood that our product, these social media content hubs, were working in a great way also in virtual events, which were then, of course, seeing a lot of traction in the middle of 2020. So our thinking was, how can we get the most out of these industry trends? And for us, it was clear we need to bring our social media content hubs into as many virtual event experiences as possible. Technically, that was very easy because our product is basically a standard widget, an iframe widget, which can embed it anywhere. So that was easy. We didn't have a lot of technical integration to do. Now it was all about identifying as many potential platforms as possible, look at the biggest ones, those with the most traction, and then setting up a lightweight partnership program, integration program that allowed us to integrate our product into theirs. And what that really means is we want to be part of their app marketplace. Most of these platforms, all of which have a tendency to be larger companies than ours. All of them have like an app marketplace, a list of integration partners. We want our logo, we want the Walls.io logo to be included in these app marketplaces so that their customers can easily find us. Maybe they also have no idea about using social media walls in the virtual events, but they will find us in the marketplace, can start a free trial and hopefully become customers like that. So that turned out to be a very successful initiative or strategy. First of all, it helped us to survive the pandemic year, the first one, while we saw quite a significant drop in revenue in the first two quarters. We were actually able to balance that out in Q3 and Q4, largely by our partnership program. So it was really a good decision to do that. And we later branched out and extended the partnership program to other categories of software platforms, event platforms first, and we later added digital signage solutions. We are now adding HR and employer branding platforms. So we are continuing and extending that partnership program.
Now, in terms of day-to-day operations, I think you've stepped away from SWAT.io and are focused on Walls.io now. I want to understand, like, how you think about positioning the two products and differentiating them from competitors. Now, SWAT.io, kind of more of a traditional social media management tool in a super crowded, super saturated market. So one, I want to understand what you do there to position and differentiate yourself. And then the same question with Walls, like, you know, this idea of social walls is, there are more and more products around that do that in different ways. So again, how do you differentiate? How do you make it clearer in terms of your positioning to your ideal customers that you are the best choice for them?
Well, this is a real struggle for both companies ongoing. I think for so many SaaS companies out there, let's be honest with ourselves. There's hardly any software category or SaaS category that is not crowded and oversaturated. We all know those SaaS landscape logo maps, right? Where you can see hundreds, thousands of logos. And honestly, no customer can differentiate us. Put the pricing pages next to each other, it's extremely hard for a customer to decide what product is the right match. So that being said, we did follow different strategies here. For SWAT.io, we made two very clear decisions early on, which are to most extent still valid and in place. The first one was, a super sharp focus on in markets. We were clearly saying, hey, we want to focus on the German-speaking markets. We have a great advantage there. We speak the same language. We're in the same time zone. And we understand the legal and later privacy-related requirements like GDPR and things like that. So we were very focused on those markets where our, frankly, bigger and sometimes maybe better, product-wise better positioned US competitors had a very hard time to compete. If we would have focused on small or medium companies, that would have been harder because they don't care so much about GDPR, for example. So at the same time, while we were focusing on German-speaking markets, we were focusing on mid to larger size companies and also larger ACV, larger contract value. And that combination allowed us to find our niche, although it's not such a small niche, and we are still growing from that market, and that turned out to be a successful decision. However, I have to say, especially since, as you mentioned, I put down my operational duties at Spot.io, I'm now in an ownership role, which means, of course, I'm very, very tightly working with the management team. But what we also see now is that for growing further than we are at right now, and we have to think ahead, of course, we will have to reconsider both of these limiting factors, both the market, shall we ever play only in the German-speaking markets, and also shall we only play on the mid to enterprise-sized companies. The latter one we already started to relax by starting to offer a self-service model with Spot.io 2 years ago, and we will see what my management team comes up with in terms of geographies and markets. So it was a good decision for a long time, but it has to constantly be reconsidered. Now, similar with Walls.io, the market by now is also pretty crowded. And again, I think the answer is positioning and trying to explain to your customer, to your potential customer, why you are so much better than that cheap competitor that undercuts your price constantly. And a lot of that answer is in quality of service. How fast is your aggregator working? Is it working with official APIs, or are you scraping, which is very unstable? So product quality really is something that you will, in my opinion, and I think of myself as a product person, always comes first in differentiating, like making clear the product value is better in investing and double investing into your product value. Secondly, as I mentioned, yeah, the pricing and the positioning should make that also clear that you are a high quality solution, that you don't want to compare yourself to the $10 per month competitor, that you are a completely different beast. And that's the challenge, of course, in for marketing and communicating your value. It's not going to be easy, but it's the only way you will survive if you are in a market where there is a very low cost competitors or new entries onto the market.
I want to talk a little bit about your role as a founder, and one, being a solo founder, and two, running two companies at the same time. When people listening to this interview or listening to you could easily be mistaken for thinking, well, you know, he had it easy. He got lucky. It worked out for him. He's got this, you know, these two businesses that have both, you know, survived and thrived. But there was a time when you realized, you know, this was a big struggle. This was affecting your personal health. It wasn't necessarily helping, you know, the growth of the companies. So give us a picture of that. Give us a picture of the struggle so people can understand, you know, the both sides of this journey here.
I want to take the opportunity and first state something completely clear. While I often talk about that I created the product and I came up with this idea and I did that, of course, it was very often me, but I wouldn't sit here almost 15 years later with two profitable SaaS businesses if it wasn't for a very, very strong team that is working behind me. Not on the co-founder level, of course, it's different, but I have people on both my teams who are working with me for 10 years or more, and without them, it would not be possible. So if I can want to be like remembered or want to be proud of something is that at least a few times I really had a good intuition to pick the right person, the right people for my team. So that being said, you are right. A lot of and that's going back to the quote I initially threw into the microphone. This once you're lucky, twice you're good or stupid. There is, of course, a certain amount of luck involved. I also won't deny that. We had a very great timing, being right in the right moment of time, focusing on social media. That was exactly the right time. That is partly luck, partly intuition. Honestly, if I would have started 10 years later, I would probably have had maybe a similar intuition about crypto. I might have failed, most likely, with that intuition. So it's not that easy. You also have to have luck. And of course, there was all this organic development of my two companies. I hope I was able to explain the history of how we came to Swarthio and Walsio, that a lot of these things happened from a point of naivety and not having like super strong vision. And I'm fine with that. That I'm not embarrassed by that or anything. It was just the way I evolved personally as an entrepreneur. But that being said, that's how I ended up in this double CEO role. Nobody in their right mind, I guess, would do this in a planned way. Two companies, two times bootstrap, two times solo founder. That is not healthy, at least for most people. I mean, maybe if you think you're Elon Musk, you can do that and run 10 companies as a CEO. But I think most human beings should focus on one thing. But it is what it is. That's what I woke up with. And you're right. It took a toll. It took many years of being focused only on work and having no balance at all with private life. And that certainly wasn't healthy all the time. Luckily, never got to a point where I really had to, like, I don't know, pull the emergency switch or whatever. But I might have been close to that. More importantly, I just realized how I'm like making my own life harder by this constantly switching back and forth. There is no multitasking, really. You just switch from one task to the other, and some people do it faster than others, but you always lose time with context switching. And I had that 10 hours a day, at least, switching between Swarthio and Walsio. So at one point, luckily, I realized this is not ideal, not for me personally, but more importantly, it's not ideal for the companies, for both companies, because we had two growing products, both had a lot of potential, and I'm very sure that by remaining in that single or double CEO role, that cost us time or potential, which we would have achieved faster if I would have made the step back from one of the companies earlier. I'm not complaining. I think in a way it was necessary, like I said, for my personal trajectory as a founder. It all has probably some meaning in the end, but it might have been better to make such decisions to step down from one earlier.
All right, we should wrap up. Let's get on to the lightning round. I'm going to ask you 7 quick-fire questions. What's one of the best pieces of business advice you've received?
So I think it's about networking and what I believe networking really should be. It's not that you're connecting, sending someone a LinkedIn connection request, and once they have accepted, start selling to them. For me, networking really means investing a lot in one-to-one relationships. And that usually means you offer your help, you give a lot of things, you pay forward until you finally maybe ask for a favor in return. That's so trivial and obvious, but yet so many people think networking is sending out as many LinkedIn requests as possible. I also am a believer in Dunbar's number, which I think says you can only have meaningful relationships with about 150 people. And I think even that number might be too high. So I think having like a small but meaningful network goes a long way.
What book would you recommend to our audience and why?
It's an older book. I think the first edition is 10 plus years ago, but they had a reprint, a revised edition lately. It's called In Search of Stupidity, 40 Years of High-Tech Marketing Failures by Merrill Chapman. And it's basically it does what it promises on the cover. It's super fun stories, especially for people who have been in the industry for more than 5 or 10 years. You will revisit a lot of fun marketing failures from the days of IBM to Microsoft up to HubSpot. It's really a fun read and very much recommended.
That's super interesting. I'm definitely going to read that book. What's one attribute or characteristic in your mind of a successful founder?
I would say it's openness and eagerness to learn and to learn from everyone in your organization, whether that's your co-founder or whether it's a customer support agent, being on eye level and being open to learn from everyone.
What's your favorite personal productivity tool or habit?
I would say it's doing a personal time audit. And I'm not sure for those who are not familiar, the concept is that for at least a month, you make a very, very detailed log of every task you do, with the goal of having a really good understanding, what am I actually spending time on? And you can do this with a Google Sheet. I'm doing it with a software tool called Timeular. Whatever you do, it's very insightful, and I'm kind of addicted to it by now, and I keep doing these time audits to optimize and to be aware of my time being spent.
I've been thinking about doing that as well, but I'm afraid what I might learn from that experience.
That's a very good point, and it is very revealing, and it can be scary, and it can hurt, but I think that's the point of it.
Yeah. What's a new or crazy business idea you'd love to pursue if you had the extra time and wanted to build a third business in parallel?
Okay. First of all, I go on the record here. I'm not going to found a third SaaS company in parallel. I swear to God, I'm not going to do that. I can also go on the record, if I ever found another company, it will not be in the social media space, but that's a different story. So I don't have any crazy business idea per se, but what I really would love to do is to do something in the physical world, like in-person events, for example. I'm super huge on community, on getting together, sharing. Something like a conference or a meetup. It doesn't have to be a business per se, but that is something I would be very interested in doing. And who knows, maybe I have some ideas. Maybe there is something happening in 2024.
Right. What's an interesting or fun fact about you that most people don't know?
Okay, those who are working with me, they know it by now, but everyone else probably not. I'm a huge fan of the country of Greece. Actually, I've been in Greece every year for my whole life, starting from age one. Wow. And I also, so I like my parents brought me there, and I have been there every year, sometimes more than once a year. So obviously I love the country, and that's a fun fact that some people know, but not everyone.
And finally, what's one of your most important passions outside of your work?
Yeah, I would say my friends, my family, my friends. That's the only thing that is as important as work, and where I spend as much time for and with.
Yeah, I totally agree. Okay, great. Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining me and unpacking the story of the last 10 or 15 years in a relatively short amount of time. Appreciate that. If people want to check out the two products, they can go to walls.io or swat.io. And if folks want to get in touch with you, what's the best way for them to do that?
Easiest, of course, is look my name up on LinkedIn. If you prefer email, that's michael@walls.io. Please don't hesitate to get in touch if you want to share something, or maybe even if you need some help somewhere, please let me know.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. I'm glad we got to do this, and I wish you and the team the best of success and a successful new year as we approach it.
Thanks a lot, Omer. It's been a pleasure. It's been fun, and it's been an honor to be on your show.
My pleasure too. Cheers. Do you dream of owning a profitable online business, or are you looking to sell yours? Bupost.com is the number one platform for entrepreneurs and founders alike. With Bupost, you can discover exclusive listings, browse listings from other marketplaces, or submit your own deal for approval. As the first platform to offer built-in acquisition financing for qualified buyers, Bupost makes it easier than ever to acquire a recurring revenue business without personal guarantees. Their experienced M&A advisory team is dedicated to supporting you throughout the process, ensuring a smooth transaction. Don't miss out on this exciting opportunity. To learn more, visit sasclub.io/bupos. That's sasclub.io/BOOPOS. Sign up today and get qualified to sell your business or find your next venture. Are you still wrestling with rigid spreadsheets that slow down your team? Jotform Tables is a solution you've been looking for. Jotform Tables combines the power of a spreadsheet with the flexibility of a database. You can collect your data through customizable online forms, and Jotform Tables automatically organizes and stores all the data submitted through your Jotform forms. You can also import and export files and collaborate with your team effortlessly. All changes are synced in real time, so everyone is always on the same page. But Jotform Tables is more than just a spreadsheet alternative. With conditional formatting, data visualization, and more than 250 integrations, it's a complete productivity platform for your team. You can even automate tasks and workflows to save time. Ready to centralize your data, boost your team's efficiency, and take your productivity to new heights? Sign up for free at sasclub.io/jotform. That's sasclub.io/jotform. Hey, are you struggling to grow your SaaS business? Well, you're not alone. But the good news is you don't have to settle for slow growth. The right tools can be a growth game changer. And that's where the SaaS Toolkit comes in. This free guide cuts through the noise and shows you the 12 essential types of tools successful SaaS startups have used to get to seven figures and beyond. It gives you specific examples and makes practical recommendations to help you find the perfect growth tools for your needs. So stop feeling stuck. Visit thesaastoolkit.com to download your free copy and unlock the growth potential you've been missing. That's thesaastoolkit.com.